There will never be a reconciliation between me and Vince Russo. There will never be kind words passed between me and Vince Russo. And I've promised my wife that I will never be in the same place as Vince Russo again because I will go to prison.
And welcome back to Dark Side of the Ring Unheard, the podcast from the Hit Vice TV series where we plunge into the Dark Side archives to uncover real revelations from some of pro wrestling's most storied characters, which have until now never been broadcast. I'm Jack Encarnacio from the Lapsed Fan Wrestling Podcast, joined by my Lapsed Fan co-host, JP Sorrow, as well as Dark Side of the Ring's executive producer and co-creator, Evan Husney. Dark Side of the Ring continues Tuesday, 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Vice TV. Evan with a look at a truly unhinged, esoteric, under-discussed cult favorite wrestler, and Chris Colt.
That's right. I'm so excited for people to check out next week's episode. It might be my favorite of the season. I really love these discovery type episodes that we get to do. Real deep cut wrestlers that you know you may not have heard of. Even maybe the most hardcore of wrestling fans have never even heard of. It was season three. We did Johnny Canine. It's kind of a similar vibe. And this episode, Chris Colt, man, for my money, the original rock and roll wrestler. You know, a guy who came to the ring in Alice Cooper accoutrement, you know, with the face paint and literal safety pins, you know, through his eyebrows and face. And he'd come out to Welcome to My Nightmare, man. And he was just this freaky rock, psychedelic, dark psychedelic wrestler. And just absolutely incredible, but also very ahead of his time. Amazing in-ring performer, great just gimmick and persona. But the story about him that really captured my imagination, which was in the trailer for the season, and it's also prominently featured right out of the gate, is this story that Jim Cornette, who we'll be talking about a lot tonight, told me about one of the more infamous matches of Chris Colt. He was in a cage match. And he had dropped a few tabs of acid shortly before heading to the ring, and I guess it peaked. He was peaking mid match, and essentially thought that these giant oversized spiders were crawling into the cage to come and get him, and he had a total freak out during the match. So that basically sold me right there. I remember Cornette telling me that years ago, and I was like, "Oh shit, this is definitely going to be an episode." And we were able to get in touch with family members. Again, wrestlers who worked with him in some of the more obscure territories like Arizona, you're going to hear about and stuff. You never really hear about Arizona. And so it's a very interesting episode, kind of cobbled together from a lot of the folks that knew him, his own diaries. It's a very, very unique and new feeling episode for us. And I'm very excited for people to check it out.
Very cool. And one of the voices, as you alluded to, that we'll hear hold court on Chris Colt is that of Jim Cornette. And Jim Cornette is a through line through the entire Dark Side of the Ring series, lending his wit and historical perspective to, it seems like, most of the subjects you've covered over the years. And while Jim Cornette is most often giving his thoughts on broad stroke subjects, it wasn't necessarily personally involved in his storied career as a manager and as a booker, there is one thread you guys have pulled on over the seasons when you sit down with him that does involve his real life nemesis and his very personal situation with former WWF and WCW head writer Vince Russo, who, of course, is also in his own right featured in several memorable Dark Side episodes. Now, in a lot of ways, the best barbs between Jim Cornette and Vince Russo have made air between the two, including most, I think, vividly in the Dark Side of the Ring Montreal Screwjob episode, which kind of has like a go-home montage of them going at each other. They also talked about each other on the Brawl for All episode. Vince Russo, of course, an architect of that idea when he was writing for the WWF in 1998, and Jim Cornette, no fan of that. But we wanted on Unheard here to focus on what both men have told Dark Side about the root of all this animosity. Like, where did this start? And it has to do, in many ways, with what is and isn't sacrosanct in pro wrestling, at least in Jim Cornette's mind and of the traditionalist mindset that he represents. And Evan, Cornette, and Russo are oil and water. Anyone who's listened to them, right, on their respective podcasting platforms over the years knows this, but the interplay you guys managed to capture between the two across the seasons, the episodes we talked about, really serves to explain the root of it, which Russo says, of course, is a one-sided animosity, but you can all be the judge. So, Evan, let's start with you. What has drawn you guys over the years to the heat between these two?
You know, there is some redundancy, as you mentioned, between, you know, the episodes of Montreal Screwjob and Brawl for All. And there is a kind of boring technical reason for that, which is Brawl for All was originally supposed to be part of our season one of Dark Side of the Ring. And, of course, it came out in season two. And so what happened is you know, we were in the throes of making the first season, blood, sweat, and tears. This is our one chance, man, you know, at making a TV show. We were sort of flying at the seat of our pants, like we might never get this opportunity ever again to do anything like this. So we were going crazy. And right somewhere on the road, I think, we had just finished Vince Russo's interview that I'm sure we'll be playing segments from tonight when we interviewed him for Brawl for All and Montreal Screwjob. And we got a call from home base, and we got word that Vice was, I don't know, you know, the show hadn't come out yet, so it wasn't a proven success. It wasn't anything anybody had heard of, and they decided they were going to pull the plug on four episodes. Four episodes they didn't want anymore that we had to kill in season one. We just come off of this crazy, like, I don't even know, maybe 15 different cities in a month type trip where we're filming all these interviews and just we're broken and we're at the end of the trip and they're like, come home, boys. And that means everything we had just shot the past month was not going to be used. So it was this very traumatic time for us. And that happened while we were editing the Montreal Screwjob. And it was kind of this, you know, it's, I'm not going to call it a rookie thing, but it's kind of more of an amateur move that maybe we wouldn't do today. But it was sort of this idea of, in the Montreal episode, it's like when you film something that's really captivating and amazing, like crazy as the Cornette Russo vitriol is, you know, you get excited and you want to use it and you want to put it somewhere. And we didn't know what the future for Dark Side of the Ring was or the show. And so we were like, well, we got to put this somewhere. This energy has to go somewhere. And we sort of thought, we kind of snuck it in under the radar for the Montreal Screwjob episode because we had to fill some time in the episode. And we felt that
it is jarring. It's like, well, why are we going down this road all of a sudden? And that makes a ton of sense.
It is jarring. It is. And when I watch it now, I cringe a little bit because it's like, nah, I wouldn't do that today. But we did it because thematically, for us at the time, it made sense that, you know, here you have, you know, Brett, Sean, this conflict where they hate each other and you sort of peel back the layers of the onion and you sort of find these two guys who are sort of the architects of, you know, pseudo architects of why we're here, and they both hate each other. You know, so there was like this, we were trying to draw this parallel. Maybe it wasn't so successful, but it did sort of derail the narrative. But in all honesty, all of that was supposed to be saved for the Brawl for All episode. It's more thematically important for Brawl for All because, you know, the Brawl for All, which is this, you know, legitimate fighting tournament they tried to do on a worked wrestling program, which was a major disaster, led to a lot of injuries, a lot of confusion as well too. And so essentially it really worked because it was the war of ideologies between two of the folks who were behind the scenes at WWF. One person, as you said, traditionalist, and then another person who's more into the shock and instant gratification sort of approach. And so it fit better there. So it was kind of this thing where it was like hindsight 2020. It would have been completely different had season one happened as according to plan. And then, of course, as soon as we got the green light for season two, it was like, all right, we can finish Brawl for All and Dino Bravo and all the other things that we had shot at that time.
That's great context. Now, JP, we've become very acquainted with the different styles that Russo and Cornette represent on Lapsed Fan, you know, watching shows from their respective eras and contrasting their outlooks on the business. Cornette, of course, coming up in the Southern tradition of presenting wrestling the way they did down there for generations. He's a son of Louisville, whereas Russo's this brash New Yorker who has this edgy take and thinks there should be more Jerry Springer in wrestling. As a fan, how do you understand the clashing philosophies
between? I mean, they're really, what it comes down to is one trying to preserve kayfabe, the other one, it's fucking wrestling. It's fake.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's what it comes down to. And I'd be lying if I said I didn't love some of the stuff that Russo did in the WWE during the late 90s. You know, obviously, so many people did. There was such great stuff. There's also a lot of bad stuff if you go back and watch, you know, episodes of Raw You know, but it was
say nothing of Nitro when he got over to WCW and Thunder.
Oh yeah, I mean forget. Yeah, I mean I don't even. I mean come on, that doesn't even need to be said. But they both have their merits. I think in the long run, you know, I personally would side with Cornette. I think Cornette's got a, you know, much more respect. Obviously, he's got respect for the business, and I don't think Russo really does in a way.
The origin of Jim Cornette on Dark Side of the Ring, he was got to be one of the first phone calls that I made after we made the Bruiser Brody pilot. Because, you know, we made the pilot, then we were getting, you know, going to make the full season, you know, the full first season. And I remember he was one of the first people I wanted to reach out to because I'd seen so many of his interviews and he's so impassioned. Like everything he talks about when he talks about wrestling, it's just filled with passion. And he can make anyone care about wrestling. If they hate wrestling, if they don't like it at all, he speaks with such exuberance about it and historical weight and brings gravitas to all of it that you can't help but being enraptured by this guy talking about it. You know, he has that ability. And we knew that would be so important for the show because, well, he's funny, A. You know, he's also a great talker and he's a comedian in his own right. But also just the ability to bring people in, to care about this. Because it was so important that, you know, if you're talking to a random person on the street about, you know, the Montreal Screwjob or the Bash at the Beach 2000, it's like the dramatic weight of these stories is not like comparatively to like current events and like things that happen in the world. It's very low on the scale. But he can sell it to you and talk to you about it in a way like it's the most important and significant thing that ever happened on planet Earth, you know? And that's very important when you're making television. You need someone who can do that. So I've always said interviewing Cornette is like a night off, you know, in the ring, so to speak. Like he just he knows how to deliver these punchy lines. He's very good at that. And that
one of the best talkers the business has ever seen in this setting and on the microphone on a wrestling TV show.
There are sometimes I think this, and I can't believe I'm saying this out loud, but the show could just be him. You know, like, there is a version of the show that's just him, and it would be fine. You know, like he's that good. You know, my own sort of beliefs about, you know, wrestling, the way I feel about wrestling, obviously more aligns with his sensibilities. Like, you know, it's kind of this, it's, you know, it's about authenticity and there's things that I like, you know, like movies and, you know, heavy metal, you know, and progressive rock, you know, and the things that I like all fetishize authenticity and we like the real deal and what it's all about, the soul and the heart of it and preserving that, you know, and not being tainted into, you know, being over commercialized or over exploited. Like we come from that same sort of soul. But there also is aspects of Vince Russo that I can get down with as well too, in terms of his outlook and how he sees story and how he wants to, you know, engage people on a level, with, even if the story's crazy, yes, some of them are, you know, out there, but at least he has, I kind of like the idea of him committing to a story and then seeing the response of the story. Like how does the story, like how do people respond to this one moment as it's happening, you know, in wrestling, and then we figure out where we pivot. It's not about necessarily like figuring it out all a year down the line. You know, maybe it is sort of about like figuring it out as we're going and seeing how it kind of takes on a life of its own. I do sort of concede that point of view. I don't know if he does a great job all the time of articulating that, but that is kind of one of his sensibilities. And I find him also completely different than his on-air persona in real life. You know, Vince Russo is he's a very nice person. He was always extremely gracious to us, and he's like the nicest guy in the world when we're at his house, and he's so accommodating and hospitable, and he's a very kind of mild mannered guy, you know, like around the house. And then as soon as that red light comes on, man, it's, you know, and then, you know, of course I did that, you know, and he's just going to 10, you know, and Jim is kind of the same way. Jim's kind of the same way. Like the nicest guy when we get to his house, him and his wife are so hospitable, so kind. Believe me, out of all the wrestlers, they're the only ones who are interested in how we're doing, you know, and stuff like that. And it's just a safe haven. It's like a little safe haven, you know, for us. But they kind of are similar in that regard. I hate to blow their spots, but they're both kind of like that, you know?
I mean, listen, I would imagine that people who can be so combative could actually be so similar. You know, that totally makes sense to me.
Yeah, and you're in a unique position there as someone who would be allowed into the inner sanctum of both. you know, because it's a very tribal thing between their respective fan bases. So,
and you know what? Sometimes in the same week, there are times where I've gone from Jim's house, next day, plane ride, next day, Vince Russo's house, you know, that's happened, you know, a few times. Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. It's a weird feeling.
So often the biggest point of controversy around Vince Russo is how much credit he can rightfully claim for the WWF's explosive growth in 97, 8, 9, and the Attitude Era, as it was called, where they really remade the nature of their television to where it was, you know, a completely different way of experiencing wrestling with a lot more violence, a lot more scantily clad women, swearing, blood, shorter matches, the sort of like schizophrenic pace, crash TV, as it was called. It was very much in the vein of Springer and South Park and Hot Topic and that whole time in our lives, right? He was putting that on the screen.
Yeah,
Hot Topic's still around.
That's the one.
Or Spencer's, perhaps, to take you back to the mall days.
Yes.
You know, here he is, and he's bringing this kind of style of television at a time when, you know, due to the NWO angle, WCW is killing WWF in the ratings every week, and they need something that really makes WWF feel like a more strident and urgent and must-see television program. And he's just given the reins, because by this point, Vince is kind of, I think it's not too far to say, kind of given up. He's kind of at his wit's end as far as what to do to reverse the momentum in losing the Monday Night Ratings War to WCW, and here's a Vince Russo who wants to bring a completely different lens to what he's, you know, what the wrestlers are asked to do and how they're asked to carry themselves and how they interact on screen and all of that stuff. So, you know, how much credit goes to Russo for that? I mean, he has his version of the story, and Cornette was there working shoulder to shoulder with Russo. I mean, these two worked together for some time at the WWF in a very similar capacity, advising Vince McMahon and the whole inner circle on where to go with wrestlers and storylines and finishes and all that kind of thing. And so I thought we'd start a bit with Cornette contextualizing kind of the moment that he sees Vince Russo fitting into at the WWF and how Vince McMahon was in this position of losing to WCW and Turner Broadcasting. And you know, here Jim, I think, kind of gets to the root of the conflict from his vantage point.
When I first started dealing with Vince Russo, I kind of had the Donald Pleasance in the original Halloween opinion. I spent the first few years trying to reach him, and then I realized that what lay behind those black eyes was so evil that it must be covered up and kept away from society. At first, I was like, okay, he's a goof. He's never been involved in wrestling. He doesn't know how this stuff works. Me, Bruce Prichard, Jim Ross, we can try to explain it to him. He's full of ideas. We can just try to give him a crash course in how to implement this and how this works. And within a few months, I realized he didn't want to learn. He didn't care about learning. He didn't want anything to be done that way. He wanted to do wrestling the way he wanted to do it, which was the Jerry Springer Show. And so when you've got a guy that's completely ignorant about how something works, but yet he's supposed to be in charge of it, and he refuses to learn or take any advice whatsoever from people who've been doing it for 20 years, you come to the normal conclusion that he's an asshole, and he's always going to be, and he's going to be nothing but trouble. And from then on, I tried to keep him locked up in that sanitarium like they tried to keep Michael Myers locked up, but it just didn't work.
Like, I mean, I know it's real-life hatred, real-life vitriol between two people, but it's so damn entertaining. I'm sorry.
Well, you've got a wordsmith in Cornette, you know, in terms of crafting.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. It's not even about that it's, you know, Vince Russo, it's just his, yeah, he's like, it's like a Jimi Hendrix guitar solo of words, you know, that's so captivating to listen to.
You wouldn't be a human being if you didn't enjoy other people fighting. Two people going back and forth and arguing with each other is, if it's not you, it's fucking entertainment.
It's like Crossfire. You know? Remember that show on CNN?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Well, I was thinking, yeah, actually, sorry, I thought you were talking about the game. I thought you were talking about the board game, the little shooter game, but well, all right.
Yeah, you could probably get that at Spencer's Gifts. But the thing is that we like wrestling promos. You know, we love a good wrestling promo.
Right.
And, you know, when someone, you know, I mean, some of the best wrestling promos come from a real place, perhaps, yeah. You know.
Yeah, you think your favorite interview only cuts those interviews when the red light's on? No, sir. Ask any ex-wife. It's definitely, they probably save their best shit for, you know, personal matters.
Yeah.
So now, when you flip it over to Vince Russo, what you always find is he always goes back to this thing that, You know, you can say all these things about my competency, Jim, but basically you're mad, bro. You're mad because Vince McMahon picked my vision over yours at a critical time for the direction of the company, and it went gangbusters. And that's kind of the North Star for Russo when he talks about this conflict. And to your point, Evan, he has a little bass in his voice, but he's not as artful necessarily in the barbs he directs towards Jim Cornette. It doesn't seem like he's put as much thought into how to, you know, most stingingly speak of him.
He's unfortunately maybe a little... He's maybe a little out of his league, you know, in that respect.
Maybe, yeah. I think he sticks to the playbook of Cornette's a hater because Vince picked me.
Right.
And that's it. So we're going to hear him say it in his own words here, addressing kind of what he sees on the flip side as the root of the conflict.
Jim Cornette hates people from New York.
There you go.
Period. End of story. He hated me because I was a New Yorker. He hated me because of my accent. He hated me because of my way of thinking. I never had a chance with Jim Cornette. On top of that, throughout our careers, there were two moments where I was chosen over Jim Cornette. And Jim Cornette likes to blame that on me rather than look in the mirror. Jim, why did they choose Vince Russo over you? Was it because, bro, he wasn't 100% set in his ways and his way was the only way? Was he a lot easier to work with? Was he a lot more open-minded than you? Could that have had anything? No, because Vince McMahon and Dixie Carter chose me over Jim Cornette. It's my fault. I screwed him out of a spot. Whatever Jim thinks in his mind, it's my fault. It's never their fault.
A reference not only to Vince McMahon, but also Dixie Carter, who used to be the boss of TNA Wrestling. Russo won the favor of Dixie Carter and was the head writer for that group for years. And it was at a time when Cornette was sort of involved. And so that was kind of like a second go between these two, you know, another face off behind the scenes. So it's very simple to Vince Russo. And look, I don't know, maybe Cornette would quibble with the characterization that he hates everybody from New York.
Well, I mean, if that were true, then he would hate me, you know.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that I can't, I don't think there's any credence in that, unfortunately.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. So Cornette remembers this time that Russo's making reference to when he was sort of chosen to lead the creative direction of the WWF. And to hear him tell it, it wasn't so much that led to the tension between the two. It was really the changes that Russo's creative mind set in motion that he saw as a dead end for the WWF and Vince McMahon ultimately. As much attention as he could get on the product by pursuing his vision for it, Russo's that is, to Jim Cornette, you know, basically it's a dead end. And for your information, the Vince that Cornette is going to reference here in the beginning of this bite is Vince McMahon, and then he gets on to Vince Russo.
Vince saw that he had to do something, and he had to open things up. Not only did he get new stars, but also he had to be riskier on his television program, more risque. He had to appeal to a younger audience. There was nothing wrong with that. Where I believe he went wrong is that he chose non-wrestling people, such as Vince Russo, to write his television, and he allowed them to tell his wrestlers what to do. That led to such ridiculous hot-shotting over and over for so long. It was crash TV. You couldn't look away, except till they all did, right, when they finally couldn't top it. The more hot-shotting, the more outrageous, the more risque, the more violent, the more constant this all became, the harder it became over a period of time to sustain it and later on to exceed it. And at some point, you were going to have to pull back.
JP, you said you quite enjoyed, you know, what Russo was bringing to the table. Does that resonate with you, that it was actually headed to an unsustainable place?
I mean, in a way, I can understand that because... was it he who was quoted once saying that he wanted to basically get to the point where you had a wrestling show without a ring at all?
Yeah, that was something that was said. Yeah,
something like that.
Vince Russo.
Like
said
to me,
that
that's yeah, yeah, yeah. And to me, that's just too far with it. Like, he had a lot of creative ideas, Vince Russo, in terms of storytelling and excitement and making a week-to-week television show exciting.
Unpredictability.
Right. The unpredictability, but again, we've talked about it on The Lapsed Fan. Sometimes predictability is a good thing. Sometimes you need to know how it's going to end as a fan. Well,
that's always been where the money is in wrestling, right? It's like, we can feel this coming. Let's be there when it happens.
Right. Because at some point, the swerve finish is going to be really fucking annoying. Yeah. And, yeah. You know,
yeah.
So there is a moment, but he goes too far with it and he breaks kind of the wall of, you know, then all of a sudden it's just wrestling, you know, now it's the fake thing. And it's like, you know, that's where you got to kind of then side with Cornette, because at least there's kind of protection of the, I want to say believability, but
legitimacy.
Yeah. The legitimacy and the idea that someone's taking it seriously. You know, I think any form of entertainment, any form of television, movies, whatever, you need to take it somewhat seriously. Otherwise it's not going to work. You can have a thing where you're kind of in on the joke and you're not like, you have to, like, you know, there are movies and shows that don't take themselves seriously, but the people making it need to be taking it seriously, not to take it seriously. You know, like, this is still an element of that.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, you know, wrestling is very secondary to the Vince Russo production, or even maybe that's the third most important thing, you know, where obviously with Jim, it's not just the wrestling and the moves and all that stuff, but it's the presentation and the conflict, why we're engaged in, why the reason that these two people are in the ring, you know, and the legitimacy of its presentation, that this could be something you're looking at is being taken seriously and is sort of respecting its history and its lineage. I totally get that. I'm on board for that. But yeah, I think with Vince Russo's approach, and especially as it wore on, maybe, you know, because, you know, hotshotting, I think when it was a new shiny thing in 1990, late 97, 98, you know, it was exciting because we were there, we were watching it. It was exciting. But then when you kind of still are pushing those same buttons and it's creeping on into, you know, the year 2000, oof, you know.
Yeah, what we see there when he does it in WCW is a situation where, you know, this is not a company that's built around the KPI of television ratings. I mean, of course, if you can get ratings up, that's what they want to see. But Vince Russo, the only thing he cared about was that the ratings came in strong on the night. And he would just keep doing things that he thought would keep people from turning the channel, which, you know, was kind of his job. But at the same time, what Cornette's KPI is how invested are people in the big match? Do they buy tickets and pay-per-view orders to... And in Russo's pay-per-views were very successful in WWF almost by osmosis, right? Because the matches, you know, it's not like there was tremendous build for all the matches. Sometimes you got on the precipice of one of those pay-per-views. You're like, who's wrestling again? Like, it was all, it just bleeded into the story of the week to week.
Sometimes too, don't forget, even some matches wouldn't be announced until the heat before the damn show.
Yeah, they'd shoot angles that night to address key matches on the show. And that was his, and we saw that thinking in WCW, and those pay-per-views did not do well. So there was an element that's, you know, Russo doesn't like when people talk about how Vince McMahon was his filter. That's kind of like a trigger word for him. But, I mean, what Vince McMahon, looking over Vince Russo, coming up with this stuff, kept alive was the idea of the big match, the idea of the pay-per-view big match. You know, Austin Undertaker, SummerSlam 98 is an example. Austin Rock. He still felt like there was someone preserving the idea that a pay-per-view wasn't just a, you know, one chapter in the story. It really felt like a big breakout moment that you had to be there, a sporting event. And that's what, you know, Cornette's there to build that moment up, in my opinion and assessment of hearing them over the years talk about it. And so, but, you know, we can say all this and we can talk ourselves into circles about it. It's all well and good. But guess what it comes down to for Vince Russo? It comes down to where you're from.
Jim Cornette's as south as south comes. Jim Cornette probably takes wrestling more seriously than anybody I've ever met in my entire... Like, Jim Cornette will kill you over professional wrestling. Jim Cornette was a guy that believed wrestling should be a certain way and should have never changed. It should have been that way in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s, up until today. It should have never changed. One of, I think, his biggest flaws was he wasn't open-minded to change. He always wanted to do things the way he was taught to do things. And again, I understand that and I respect that, but times change. Everybody changes with the times. And I think that was always the clash between myself and Cornette, where he was very traditional and things should be done a certain way. And I was like, bro, that may have worked back then, but I don't think that's going to work today. And I tried to change things up a little bit. And I think, you know, he just had an issue with that.
Yeah, it's always Evan through the lens of like the personality to Russo. It's not about the philosophy and the merits of it.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm trying to remember what episode it was, if we used it in the screw job thing or if it was in the Brawl for All thing, where where Russo criticizes Cornette's ideas about, you know, if you want to get somebody over, you have them coming out of a box, bro.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know? But who's coming out of a box, you know? And he's talking about this whole thing about the only way to get somebody over is if he comes out of a box. You know, this is 1996, bro.
Like the thing where, you know, a standout angle they would do in territories like the Memphis territory was they have a mystery box on the TV screen and everyone's going to stay tuned to find out who comes out of the box. And whoever comes out of the box is automatically over. That's like a rule of thumb. And so Russo would hold that out as like an outmoded idea, even though Chainsaw Charlie came out of a box when he was head writer.
Fucking killed. Is what it did.
Well, I'm sure he would disavow any involvement in that one, but
no, but like, yeah. And it's just funny. That's just a funny thing, but I'm sure, you know, I don't know. They have such a fundamental difference that I don't think they'll even ever understand where each other is really even coming from.
It's kind of funny because it's like when you get down to their philosophies, if they actually could kind of separate and compartmentalize their responsibilities, they could probably be two very good bookers together.
Cornette does say, like, he had a bunch of ideas, and he doesn't say that derogatorily, but his thing was, like, Russo, like, crossed that line into being almost like a boss. Like, he was somebody that was, you know, kind of orchestrating the wrestlers in a way that isn't appropriate for a booker to do. The wrestler should have a little more agency, and but at the same time, Russo was having these guys do wacky things they never thought they'd do in wrestling, and it was working. If you judge by revenue and pay-per-view and television ratings. So it was a really wacky period of time in that regard where things were working and you could like say it was because we threw away the playbook, or you could say it's because we preserved a couple of things underneath the playbook that always work and were traditional about wrestling.
There's so many things. There's so many factors at that time, because that time was also, again, people always talk about this, but look at the talent that was available at that time. You had some of the best talent ever at your disposal, you know, to do so much.
And Austin and Rock, you had two generational main eventers on TV at the same time.
Even the mid-card guys were incredible. Like, by today's standards, like, any of the mid-card guys would be top guys, you know? And you had so many, and you had so much to pull from, and the show was just more exciting, you know? Like, the way the show was produced was just better, you know, in terms of... Like, do you remember, like when you go back and you watch, like, a Raw from, like, 1998, and you just, like, see the excitement in the crowd of all those people with, like, thousands of signs, and it's just, like, the signs and the pyrotechnics, it's just the excitement of that, it just feels like it's a happening, you know? It feels like this is something where you gotta be, man. And it's just the way that they produced television back then. The way it looked, the way the cameras looked, the quality and the texture of, you know, standard def, you know, there's just something about it that just was so much more alive than it is today.
There wasn't so much screen either. Now we have all screen everywhere.
Yeah,
there's got to be an LED screen covering every inch of everything.
Flat lighting, just really gross, overlit, terrible lighting, terrible camera work. That's why I can't watch. I don't want to get into me on modern wrestling. I can't watch it mainly because the way that it is produced. It is unwatchable.
And we're the ones from the lapsed fan.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You guys keep watching your modern wrestling.
Yeah, we're suffering at the altar you're
Jesus
speaking of.
Jesus Christ. Unwatchable.
It was a time of big production breakthroughs for sure. And, you know, now you see signs in the crowd and you can't even trust that they didn't manufacture them and put them in the hands of the fans. Everything's synthetic.
I want to say, too, I think another unique thing about that time period, about both and them, Cornette and Russo, is that, and we've talked about this on The Laps Fan, is the idea that the fans who wanted something different are, you know, these aging Hulkamaniacs, you know, who are tired of that stuff. And it was a perfect storm of elements.
Well, you had Hulkamaniacs who now had teenage angst.
Right, exactly.
Hot Topic, a little Hot Topic clothes in their drawers.
And glued to with scantily clad women for the first time in wrestling.
Exactly. And there was such like an element of the time that all these factors came together and exploded at the same time, that it was really remarkable when you look back at it.
What a time to live through. Yeah, we still talk about the Attitude Era for that very reason. So I guess the purest distillation of Jim Cornette's problems with Russo's vision for wrestling was the Brawl for All. It makes a ton of sense what you said earlier, Evan, that a lot of the back and forth that we saw in the Montreal episode for logistical reasons was actually shot with the Brawl for All in mind, because it was Russo's idea for this whole tournament where wrestlers, if you don't recall, would actually get in the ring and really box and fight each other without any licensing or training or even much in the way of medical examination. It's like, what if these guys really fought each other on live TV without any, without really a grasp of what actually happens when two guys who aren't accustomed to fighting start throwing punches and how dangerous it can get. Not in terms of like, you know, deathly injury, but just in terms of injury in general, you know, tearing things, breaking things, concussions, all that. And the episode puts a really fine point on it, and it has Russo sort of laying down the reasons, some of them specious, as to why he did this, you know, to see some guys that rubbed him the wrong way get their actual toughness proven on television. But all that said, it's telling, because when Cornette talks about his issues with Vince Russo, he talks about the Brawl for All, and he talks about how Dr. Death Steve Williams, who was a veteran wrestler WWF had brought in, put into the Brawl for All tournament, apparently with this soft expectation that because he had a great amateur wrestling background, that he would win the shoot tournament, shoot being the term for real fighting, and then be a great marketable opponent for like Steve Austin or the top guys in WWF, make a lot of money with this new star built in this tournament. The idea that, you know, you didn't see the potential deep, deep downside risk of Dr. Death going down like he did in the tournament for real. And Cornette confronts Russo about this, and also about the fact that, you know, this tournament is featuring wrestlers that we think of as gimmicks with fake stage names, fighting in some cases under their real names, just not even keeping any fidelity to their television character in this one Brawl for All segment.
Russo was so demented and delusional that he was drawing a line between what was real and what was fake on the same program. He not only had the guys fighting for real, but he had them exposing their real names and their real personalities, which for these guys was not a benefit. And on the same program, they would then turn around the following week and be someone completely different, even though it was still the same guy. You have to do a lot of LSD or live downstream from the nuclear plant to understand how Russo's brain, or what's left of it, works. And this, to him, made perfect sense. And everybody else, this was kind of the beginning of people starting to hate Vince Russo, because this did so much damage in such a short period of time and made no sense on so many different levels.
Definitely didn't do him any favors with Jim Ross, who was a good friend and advocate of Steve Williams, a fellow Oklahoman, and of course was head of talent relations for the company at the time and the lead Monday Night Raw announcer. He was none too happy to see Dr. Death put in this position. And after it goes down, as talked about and discussed in the Dark Side of the Ring episode in the Brawl for All tournament, Dr. Death gets knocked out and tears his quad or tears his hamstring or something in the contest, is one match in the whole thing. And Cornette recalls a moment of actually confronting Russo about the fallout.
And my heart sunk, and I got a bad feeling in my stomach, because I knew here went Dr. Death's WWF career. It was over before it had even got started. Here's our next main event guy. It's going to draw money. Gone. There comes Russo walking down the hallway. I said, "Are you happy? You just cost a company $5 million in one night." And he looked at me and, "What are you talking about?" I said, "You idiot. Dr. Death Steve Williams just got beat on live television in front of everybody. What difference is now? Bart Gunn's going to be a star now." I said, "I want to kill you. I would like to just squeeze you until your britches are full and your eyeballs pop out."
When Jim says, I'll kill you. You know, that moment, which is in the episode, but that moment, that was one of the times that I actually was like, okay, maybe it's not so fun and games anymore, because he came at the camera. Like, you, if you go back and watch, it's actually a GIF. People have GIFed this moment now. Whenever Jim's pissed about something on Twitter, you'll see that "I'll kill you" moment, you know, gifified. And he literally is choking. He's having like a choking gesture and he's coming towards the camera, and literally he came at the whole camera and the whole thing shook, you know. And I remember that we had some camera ops or someone who hadn't worked with us much before, and they had never seen anything like this, and they don't know where the hell they are or what the hell's going on. And I remember that moment, they were genuinely terrified, because it's real. You know, this rivalry is definitely real, and at least, you know, I'm one-sided or not, but, you know, Jim, these feelings are definitely genuine. And I do remember we had this very, now in hindsight, stupid idea, which was when we were sketching out the Brawl for All episode and episode, you know, for season one, we were like, is there a possibility of getting them in the same room, you know, to shoot a little B-roll, you know? That was kind of like the thought, you know, without knowing the severity of the situation, of course. And so I remember one of my first trips to Kentucky to be with Jim and pitching him that idea. And he just looked at me and he was, you know, he's not in full cornet mode. He just was very lucid and just said, I've made a promise, you know, to my wife, just as he said at the top of the show, I've made a promise to my wife and I can't, you know, but he said it in that way, you know, like I can't, because, you know, I'll go to jail, and, you know, exactly what he said. And we're learning about all this, but in that moment I was like, oh yeah. Like, as a producer, like, there's no way this can ever happen. You know,
it'll have to be a very universally beloved charity one day, that they'll have to share the stage and go face to face.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, just put great. Like a, you know, a plexiglass wall between them and just have a battle of wits.
Oh,
you know what I mean? God. So, but yes, so
good.
While we did hear that Jim Cornette vitriol there on the episode of Dark Side of the Ring, what it does do is serve up a contrast to what we're about to hear from Vince Russo, because you asked him about this moment. Presumably, you would interview Jim first, so you knew that there was this backstage confrontation after what happened to Dr. D. And so Russo, I think it's a very characteristic response. I think it really speaks to the difference between how both of these gentlemen feel about this feud and how seriously they take it. Here's Russo's recollection of this this confrontation that to Jim Cornette says it all, and to Vince Russo says, well, just about nothing.
Did you ever have any conversations with him about the Brawl for All?
I'm sure I did, but none that I remember. But I'm sure I did, but I don't remember any.
And can you describe, like, what his position was at the time?
Well, at the time, like I said, when I first started writing, it was me, him, and Vince at the time. And then he was eliminated from that process for the exact reason that I'm talking about. Vince and I were talking about this new attitude era and doing things a different way and throwing out the wrestling handbook altogether. And he was doing 1970s Memphis. And, you know, the more we had these meetings, the more we saw that, you know, we were on two different tracks. And then at the end of the day, you know, Vince said, bro, I'm going this way with me. And Jim was no longer writing. And that's where a lot of the problems started, unfortunately.
What do you think, Evan? Do you think he remembers that confrontation full well, but wanted to pretend he didn't?
I don't know. I honestly don't know if those instances really, you know, made the same impact, you know, as they did for Jim, because it probably was just another day on the job. It wasn't like the lifestyle, you know, and the, you know, yeah. I mean, he's just thinking about it again in a completely different way, with a completely, you know, different set of passion for it. You know, he's wanting to write a television show. And you know, for Jim, it's like the weight of, you know, Dr. Death and what's happening and how calamitous this whole thing is. It just plays and hits much harder for him, which I totally understand. And I don't know. Either he's blocked it out or he's not wanting to be forthright with that. But I never got the sense of, you know, necessarily that he wasn't being truthful. I mean, there are moments where I'm I don't know. Like, I'm not, things don't add up. You know, I remember in the Montreal Screwjob episode when you're watching them talk about the meeting with Vince at his house when they're discussing the finish for Montreal Screwjob, and, you know, Cornette lays out a pretty detailed, thorough explanation of how he brought up, you know, the Strangler Lewis double cross, right? You know, it's pretty elaborate. And I have to say, too, that that was incredible. That was such an amazing thing. I remember when we showed up to Jim's house for the very first time to do that interview, and he said to me, he said, I'm gonna say something I've never said before about this. And, you know, he's like, I'm not leaving my house these days, and I don't care who gets mad at me. It was really cool that he trusted us and gave us that little nugget about that that had never been out there, about how he had pitched the whole, you know, that that whole finish and sort of pitched the idea of the sharpshooter being what Sean puts Brett in. So that was cool. That was amazing.
And then totally apropos of the feud, Russo turns around and says he had the idea.
Yeah, right. I had just put him in the sharpshooter, bro. You know, but obviously there's no grace to that. There's no like historical context. There's no, you know, like when you're listening to someone kind of flippantly telling it, and then someone who's giving you like, you know, deep, thought out, meticulous historical, you know, background information. So, yeah, there are times like that where it doesn't quite add up, you know. Yeah. But Cornette has an amazing memory, by the way, I must add. His memory is very sharp.
Yeah, that's why he's so intimidating in a format like this. You know, I wouldn't want to debate him, you know, because he's going to have the artillery ready, and he's going to have the cadence down and the word choice down. And
that's what I was saying. He was out of his league. That's like you can't compete with anybody I see on Twitter. Whenever I see someone going after Jim about, you know, something, I'm like, dude, what are you doing? You know, like, what are you doing?
For Cornette, the Brawl for All was just par for the course for ideas that ended disastrously, that he really feels Vince Russo should have but didn't take a full blame for.
Here's the thing with Russo. Every time he has one of these dog and pony show ideas that don't work, he blames, well, they didn't know how to execute it, or the talent didn't fully embrace it, or standards and practices kept me from going as far with it as I wanted to go, or if only this had happened, or if only so-and-so had done that. He never comes out and says, I didn't know anything about wrestling. I didn't respect anything about wrestling or the people doing it. And I was given a position to by a multimillionaire then, now he's a billionaire, owner of a company who was sweating, losing a promotional war, and I was allowed to do whatever I wanted to do. And so, yes, the old man masturbating on furiously on the street corner gets some attention, and so does the two dogs screwing on the side of the road for a little while. But if you see that every day, you start driving right past it, and you don't even notice it.
That sentence of dog and pony show really resonates with me, because I do see it in modern wrestling, not going to name any names, but when you do see things that are put together with a lot of irony and not a lot of sincerity, and they're put together with that in mind, and when you're not taking something seriously, you know, it does have this effect of just ironic kind of hipster bullshit, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah. I mean, look, if the people putting wrestling together take it less seriously than the fans do, then it's not going anywhere. The people putting it together have to take it three times more seriously than the fans ever will for it to even have a shot at being something that has legs.
Or it's without irony, and you have, like, when we were talking about Herb Abrams, it's like, there is sincerity there, you know, in what they're doing. And they are taking it seriously. Are they good at what they're doing? No. But there isn't, you know, this sort of overly self-awareness factor, you know. And that's when you do.
Yeah, like you're never going to catch me taking it too seriously.
Right. And that's when your audience does become very niche.
So we have Russo talking about those who blame him. And, you know, he told you guys, I don't have to screw Jim Cornette. They know Cornette was stuck in the 70s. He's never going to move off of it. He says, you know, I was just easier to work with, more open-minded. He doesn't need to screw anybody. He says, you're not going to outwork me. You're not going to be smarter than I am. That's what it really comes down to. Not who Vince Russo is, who they have convinced himself in their mind that Vince Russo is. That's what it really comes down to at the end of the day. And bro, I'll tell you, I don't give a shit, Russo told you guys. I'm at a point in my life, I don't care what you think about me. So, does Vince Russo have hate towards Jim Cornette?
I don't hate Jim Cornette. I don't hate any of these people, bro. I went to work. I did the best job I possibly could. I don't hate any of you people. I am a Christian man. There's no hate in my body. Bro, if you want to continue to hate me in your 60s, in your 70s, you know, Jim Cornette's going to be around to piss on my grave. Jim, piss away on my grave. I don't care because I know I did things the right way. It was hard work. It was work ethic. And at the end of the day, this was a job. This was not a life. My family is my life, not wrestling.
And let's just say the feeling isn't mutual.
I not only love and respect the professional wrestling industry for the money that I've made in it and the fun I've had, but I was a fan from the time I was a kid. It ran very well until outsiders and asswipes like Vince Russo got involved and screwed it all up. And he was so bad at his job, and he was such an asshole while he was performing it. He was such an arrogant prick that I determined that because he put a stake in the heart of what I and so many other people loved, that I would spend the rest of my life as my personal hobby, pointing out his shortcomings, making fun of his failures, and telling everybody that all along he didn't know what he was doing, and it was the talent in the ring and the guys putting their bodies on the line that sold those tickets and drew that money. There will never be a reconciliation between me and Vince Russo. There will never be kind words passed between me and Vince Russo. And I have promised my wife that I will never be in the same place as Vince Russo again because I will go to prison. And I won't even be able to... I will lose it, and I have anger management issues, and I won't be able to stop myself. I start vibrating, and then I do these things, and I remember them afterwards. It goes that far.
Anytime we've examined episodes like these, okay, like the Montreal Screwjob, like the Brawl for All, or even more recently with Bash of the Beach 2000, it's the drama of it, of these incidences, come from the warring ideologies in the war room. You know, the people who come from the different points of perspective, and they have their own opinions and idea, and that's interesting to capture. A lot of people, especially those who don't care or respect about wrestling or know a lot about wrestling, wouldn't even think that something as important as it is to Jim Cornette would even take place. You know, that there is even the stakes for someone like him, you know, and I think it's important to show that. I think it's important to show where the motivations of certain people like Russo were at the time when they were most popular, and how the industry changed and evolved, but also the people behind it and what went into obviously creating a lot of these memories that we love and these moments in wrestling that we still hold on to. But it raises the importance of the whole thing. It's like if you're watching two guys who worked on the same sports team, you know, maybe they're part of the coach, you know, maybe they're part of the coach team, or there's something, and they just have a completely different ideology about the game, and the game means two completely different things to one another, you know. And there's just something fascinating about that. And I think it's always been a source of entertainment, of course, because Jim is very skilled on the mic. Of course, if that weren't part of it, who knows if it would be nearly as interesting. But yeah, and I think that, man, with this new project we're working on, which I don't know if by the time you're listening to this recording, if it's been announced yet, but we did interview Vince Russo for that project, and we got even deeper into his philosophies, and I felt like I understood them more than I ever had. Not that I say I'm agreeing with everything or co-signing everything, but there are moments in which I think I had sort of agreed more about where his perspective is coming from. And look, man, honestly, last thing I'll say is, I know I'm rambling, but there are days, you know, working, and I'm not in the wrestling business, of course. I'm just adjacent, you know, in terms of, we make the show involving wrestling personalities, but there are definitely days where I feel like Vince Russo, you know, where it's like, it's a job, bro. Like, it's just wrestling. You know,
a defense mechanism in part.
I have those days, man. I have those days. I've had days, you know, in dealing with a lot of these personalities, and especially dealing with the culture of this industry and a lot of its fans, who always aren't my favorite people, But there are definitely times where it's like, man, I had all these action figures on my wall, and I had all this wrestling ephemera everywhere, posters and figures and all this stuff. All that shit right now is packed up in a box and stuffed under my bed because I don't want to see it. You know, I don't want to see that shit, you know, because
that's what you get.
That's what you get. And so I understand sort of the bitterness and where it can come from, you know, of something that you, I'm sure at one point he was a lot more enthusiastic about. So I do understand that too. But again, man, it's like something we learn as fans, and especially you guys can relate to this too. We get in because we love wrestling, and, you know, we grew up and we loved watching Big Boss Man and, you know, these big larger than life characters in the ring and so on and so forth. But then we get really fascinated about what happens behind the scenes. And what happens behind the scenes is more dramatic. It's more captivating. The rivalries are more intense. The shit talking is better behind the screen than it is in front of the camera. You know, so, and this is just one of those great off-screen rivalries, man, that if it were on screen, which is what where we tried to put it, it definitely draws. So,
I love it. That's beautifully summarized. So for more from Jim Cornette, at the very least, you can tune in to the next episode of Dark Side of the Ring. It's coming up Tuesday, 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Vice TV, with a look at a true original in the wrestling business, the troubled Chris Colt, with insights from Jim Cornette, Colt's family, and a range of other people that saw him operate in this one-of-a-kind business. But for now, and for us, it's back to the vault. And we'll see you next time on Dark Side of the Ring, Unheard.